This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today, a conversation with Jesuit priest James Martin. Father Martin was working in corporate America when he experienced his call to the priesthood. A graduate of the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business, he worked for GE in corporate finance and human resources for 6 years. I'll ask Father Martin this afternoon about faith, the priesthood, and his vocation. We'll also talk about the sexual abuse crisis confronting the church. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions. Join us with a phone call. In Champaign-Urbana, our number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Father Martin is associate editor of America, the national weekly Catholic magazine. He is the author of two books, including In Good Company, The Fast Track from the Corporate World to Poverty, Chastity, and Obedience. He is also the editor of a third book, How Can I Find God? Father Martin has worked in homeless shelters as a prison chaplain and with African refugees. He was ordained in 1999. Father Martin, good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
You were raised as a Catholic, but you say in your book, In Good Company, your religious education came to a halt after you were confirmed. And you say your concept of prayer was quite basic, of the "Dear Lord, let me ace this test" variety. When did you begin to feel a real, genuine pull toward your faith?
Well, my faith life, as you said, sort of stopped a little bit in, say, third or fourth grade after confirmation. Like a lot of Catholics, my sort of formal religious education stopped then. And I went to church more or less regularly over the next, say, 10 years. But it really wasn't until I was working at GE that I started to think more seriously about questions of, you know, what my life meant and, you know, what's the meaning of life, and started thinking more seriously about religion. So really not until my late 20s.
Mm. You wrote a very moving piece for the October 8th issue of the magazine America. It was a journal of the first days you spent working in the wreckage of the World Trade Center.
Mm-hmm.
And you reflected on the faith of the people who worked at that place.
Mm-hmm.
How did faith manifest itself there?
For me, very powerfully, I saw in this place of great desolation and great suffering an incredible working of charity among the people. And essentially, it manifested itself through the generosity and the charity and the love of the people, the firefighters, the police officers, and the rescue workers that came together so quickly in response to that tragedy. So I really have never experienced God's Spirit as powerfully as I had at Ground Zero, which is a strange thing to say, and I think it strikes people as kind of ironic. But for me, it's also the Christian message of new life coming out of suffering.
Mm. Was faith also tested at the site?
Pardon me?
Was faith also tested at the site?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, there's so many people in the United States and certainly in New York City who are questioning, where was God? Why is this happening? But once again, my primary experience, you know, starting to work there on, I think it was September 13th, was this real outpouring of charity and this outpouring of faith. So, you know, those two things coexisted, people's difficulties with the situation itself and also their desire to help. So as in many situations of personal and communal suffering, you had that sort of yin and yang there of the questioning and also the response, the doubt and the faith, you know, together.
Mm. It was 2 years from the time you first began thinking about the priesthood until you decided to apply to become a Jesuit. What were those 2 years like? What were your doubts?
That's a good question. I had initially approached the Jesuits pretty, I want to say, sort of haphazardly or impulsively. And when I first got some information about the Jesuits, I looked at all the information about taking vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, and living in community and working with the poor. And I thought, well, that's ridiculous. I couldn't possibly do that. And I really set aside those brochures and those books and whatnot. And for the next 2 years, continued my work at General Electric in Connecticut, and basically got more and more disenchanted. you know, was getting more and more stressed out, and got so stressed out that I ended up having ulcers and all sorts of, you know, stomach problems, and went to a psychiatrist to deal with that. And one day in the middle of our therapy, he said to me, well, you know, you seem very unhappy with your life. And I said, I am. And he said, what would you do if you could do anything you wanted to do? And I said, oh, that's easy. I'd be a priest. I sort of blurted that out. And I remember him saying, I remember myself saying, well, he said to me, well, why don't you do that? And I thought, well, gee, why don't I? And that, you know, sort of the scales fell from my eyes, to use a biblical image. And I thought, this is crazy. Why am I putting this off any longer? And I, you know, pulled out that stuff from my desk and started the process of application to the Jesuits.
Well, tell us a little bit about life on the corporate fast track.
Well, you know, at the beginning, I graduated from the Wharton School at Penn in 1982. And at the beginning, it was very exciting. I was working with General Electric in New York City and had a lot of money and was doing very well and, you know, was just sort of living the typical yuppie life in the early 80s. Moved to Stamford, Connecticut to take a sort of a higher position in the company. And the more I worked there, the more disillusioned I got, and the more it seemed that the logic of my life was pretty circular. I worked so I could support myself, so I could work. And it started not to make any sense any longer. And really, the types of things I thought that would satisfy me, a good job, the money, the security, really were not satisfying, and that once again led me to start thinking about doing something else with my life.
Yeah, you kept silent about your possible vocation. I get a sense from the book In Good Company that it felt really good when you finally told your friends at work.
Well, it did. I mean, there was a certain glee of sort of surprising people. Some, you know, it's like you have a big surprise that no one knows. But there was a real sense of peace within myself that this is what I was meant to do. And it certainly felt more, the idea of being a Jesuit and eventually being a priest certainly filled me with a lot more enthusiasm and joy than the idea of continuing on in the business world. But, you know, needless to say, since I hadn't shared too much of my faith journey with my friends, most of my friends at work and my colleagues were really shocked and some of them horrified.
Mm. I wonder, though, you know, given the difficulties of working in that culture, if your decision and you're telling them about it and you're talking with them about it, if it had any influence on them to make a change in their lives.
Well, that's a good question. I think that certainly the people with whom I worked were all, you know, good people, and, you know, a lot of them are already settled in what they were doing, and, you know, for example, some of them had families, so I think that they were more settled than I was. But I do know that among some of my friends from college and from work, there is a sense, in at least from how I see it, that my entering the Jesuits made them more curious about faith questions and about spirituality. And they certainly, after I told them about my decision, this would have been in 1988, to enter the Jesuits, became more willing to ask me questions about meaning in their life and spirituality. And that has continued to the point where, you know, I think I'm, you know, for better or worse, the person they go to when they have questions like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, why the order the Jesuits?
Well, initially, I found the Jesuits very appealing because they can take your talents and use them. You can, for example, be a Jesuit. You can be a Jesuit architect. You can be a Jesuit doctor. You can be a Jesuit teacher. That's, I think, the role that most people know Jesuits in. But there was a sense of being able to use your talents in a wonderful way. I think also the idea that Jesuits lived in community. They're a religious order, which means they're not diocesan priests, so they live in community and they're free to do a variety of kinds of ministries instead of, for example, diocesan priest is more focused on parish ministry. But, you know, as the saying goes in the Jesuits, you stay for different reasons than you enter. And while that work and ministry, you know, certainly still appeals to me, now it's more the spirituality of the Society of Jesus and the Jesuits, Ignatian spirituality, which is a spirituality of finding God in all things, that really appeals to me. And it's funny, I've told people recently that, you know, a Jesuit it used to be something that I did. Now it's who I am, really. So it's just become, you know, part of me now. And which I think is, you know, it's like a marriage. People get married and they expect it to be a particular way. And the reasons they stay married and the reasons that help them to continue their marriage, I think, are a lot different than, you know, when they're first engaged.
Mm. What's required of a candidate for the Jesuit priesthood?
Well, it's funny you should ask that, because just this weekend I was on a candidate review board, and to enter, you have to go through, first of all, a battery of psychological tests that are very extensive. You have to go through a long series of interviews with Jesuits and also with lay people with whom the Jesuits work, so maybe 6 or 7 interviews. You have to write an autobiographical statement. You have to have recommendations. You have to, these days now, go through a background check, all sorts of background checks. And it's a very, very extensive process. And then you have to go through this review board, and then the results of the review board are brought before the head of the Jesuit province, who would be the head of kind of a geographic section of the country. And then you enter the Jesuit novitiate, and even then there's 2 years of probation before you take your first vows. So it's rather extensive.
Are other orders as rigorous in terms of accepting candidates?
I would say that the other religious orders are probably just as rigorous. I don't know if they're more rigorous. I would think that, I wouldn't know what more one could do, but I think that the larger religious orders like the Dominicans, the Franciscans, I think they all have the same general procedure with you, where you have interviews, psychological evaluations, autobiographical statements, and also I should add retreats too. There's a spiritual component to this, of course. You're meeting with a spiritual director, and you also do retreats. So I would say, for the most part, yeah, the other religious orders are pretty strict when it comes to accepting people.
Mm. One may also become a Jesuit brother. What's the difference between brother and priest?
Well, the brother doesn't feel called to ordination, and so the Jesuit brother is someone who feels called to the life of poverty, chastity, and obedience, and also to life in community with other Jesuits, and also to the work of the Society of Jesus. So, for example, one of my best friends in the Society is a Jesuit brother who teaches at a Jesuit high school in New York City, and he's a wonderful Jesuit and just a real model Jesuit for me, a very holy person, very hardworking. And yet, you know, he doesn't feel called to ordination, to become a priest. And that's been a long tradition in religious life and certainly in the Jesuits since it started.
So brothers live in community with Jesuit priests.
Mm-hmm.
So are they celibate?
Yes, yeah. They take the three vows, poverty, chastity, and obedience. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Do all Catholic priests take those vows, poverty, chastity, and obedience?
They don't. Another good question. That's kind of a common misconception. The key vow that they wouldn't take is a vow of poverty. You know, for example, a diocesan priest, someone who would be working in a parish, would actually get a salary. Now, that doesn't mean by any stretch of the imagination that they're, you know, wealthy men. Although, you know, some people have, you know, they invest well and they can save up their money. So they don't take the vow of poverty. They are, you know, called to live simply. They make a promise of celibacy, and they have obedience to their bishop. But it's the vow of poverty and living in community, I think, that distinguishes religious order priests from diocesan priests.
Mm. Do many priests come to the priesthood after another career?
Well, now they do. More and more people are entering later in life. I think certainly in the Jesuits, you have people entering. Let me put it this way. We looked at, 6 or 7 people this weekend for the New England, New York, and Maryland provinces, and I don't think any of them were younger than 24. You know, most of them were in their mid to late 20s. Some were in their 30s. So these are people who have worked for a while and have, you know, tried to make ends meet and have, you know, earned a living, which I think is good. I think that enables Jesuits and priests to more fully understand people's problems and what goes on day to day.
Reading your book, In Good Company, I was struck by the culture of the corporate world and how brutal it can be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've been reading over the months now about Enron and Arthur Anderson and ethical lapses and ethical meltdowns.
Mm-hmm.
And today, you know, the church faces a great crisis.
Mm-hmm.
The sexual abuse of children by priests and the cover-up by
mm-hmm.
church leaders. What are your thoughts about how the church is responding to this crisis?
Well, you know, I think the first thing to say is that, you know, over the past, you know, however many 30, 40 years, that the church has responded in some places very poorly. I mean, what we're seeing now is a backlog of examples of how the church has dealt with this situation very poorly. And I think, you know, what the church is trying to do and has tried to do in the last 6 months is sort of play a game of catch-up and trying to rectify some of the mistakes that were made in the past. I think that the meeting that they had in Dallas was a good first step. It was the most important thing. They apologized. They took responsibility, that is, the bishops. They set forth a plan that they hoped would, you know, end having any sexual abusers in ministry. So it's a good first step. I don't think it's the end in terms of what the bishops need to do, and I certainly don't think it's going to settle things by any event, because, you know, you're going to have to see how the bishops do. I mean, how will this plan pan out, and what will the response be from the laity? So I think there's a lot of open questions still.
Yeah. What else would you like to see them do?
Well, I think, you know, some of the bishops need to take responsibility for some of their actions, and I think resignations would probably be a good way to indicate to people the seriousness with which they take what they did or what they didn't do. I think this question of, you know, whether or not priests are made to, you know, turn over their priesthood, i.e. be laicized, which is the sort of technical term, is kind of an open question. But I think the one thing that people wish, and that I wish that some of the bishops would do, those who feel that they have been particularly negligent in this area, is resign. I think that it would be a real show of penance. Now, I'm not, you know, I can't say who would do that and who wouldn't do that, but I do think that, you know, in the Catholic tradition of reconciliation and confession, you have confessing your sins, you have seeking forgiveness, but you also have penance. And I think that, you know, some of the bishops that have engaged in these actions may want to consider penance. What is their penance?
Hmm. What is penance?
Penance is a way of reconciling yourself to God through sacrifice and through, you know, trying to do good deeds. I mean, traditionally, if you go into the confessional, if you're a Catholic, the priest will listen to your sins and then pray with you for absolution, that is, forgiveness of sins from God, and will also ask you to, quote-unquote, do a penance. And usually that consists of prayers or good works, and it's something to do to sort of reconcile yourself to the community and to God. And I think, once again, to use that as a microcosm for what some of the bishops have done, I still think that there is a sense that that there is some penance that needs to be done.
Mm. It's clear that church leaders knew there was a very serious problem. I read last week or the week before in the New York Times that American bishops meeting in Minnesota back in 1985 were given a document that reported that the situation had the potential to be catastrophic.
Mm-hmm.
Has the very structure of the church contributed to the scope of the problem?
I think that the church, you know, certainly the church hierarchy, one part of it that might have contributed to this, although there's so many factors, I think, that enter into this, is that people are generally unwilling in chanceries and in dioceses and archdioceses to challenge what someone above him might say. I think that there's a reluctance, you know, in a sense there's a real trust that comes with, you know, working for the bishop or working for the archbishop or for the cardinal, that I think is good. I mean, they generally, priests trust their bishops. The problem is when a bishop is doing something, and this is, I think I want to underline, you know, there are some bishops in the United States that have done a very good job with addressing these cases over the past 20 years. But there, you know, have obviously been some bishops who have done a very poor job. And I think that the structure of the church that encourages priests to be, well, deferential to the bishops certainly does not help in these situations, you know, where the bishops, I think, in some cases needed to have been more challenged. Part of the problem, though, I think, is that you're dealing with people for whom these issues, like for so many people in the country, are almost unbelievable. I mean, you have bishops who are in their, you know, 60s and 70s who I think simply weren't brought up to deal with these problems. That wasn't in their training, that wasn't in their family background. That is, you know, dealing with these problems head on wasn't in their family background. And that's not an excuse. I'm not trying to excuse these actions. But it is, I think, a reason that some of these things were set aside and that some of these problems were ignored for so long.
Mm. The bishops meeting in Dallas this month decided to require dioceses to establish lay committees to advise bishops on sexual abuse issues. Do you know how these committees will work, and what do you think about that situation, that decision that the bishops made?
I think it's an excellent decision. You know, there is already, I think, a lay, predominantly lay-run board in Chicago, in the Chicago Archdiocese that has been operating. And I think that just this, the sign value, for one thing, of lay people being on the majority, being in the majority on these boards, is very good for people to see, because I think it shows people that the bishops are serious about bringing lay people into the decision-making process. And I think, generally speaking, you can probably get better experts from among the lay persons than you can from priests. I mean, you're drawing, as a result, from a much wider pool of expertise. You'd be able to get psychiatrists and psychologists and legal people you know, sociologists and people that would be able to understand the effects of sexual abuse. So I think it's terrific. I mean, I'm all for that. I think it's great that they're bringing in lay experts, and I think it can only help. And also, I think they too, because their either livelihoods don't depend directly on the bishop, would, you know, might be more willing to speak you know, some harsh words to the bishop if he needs to understand something. You know, whereas a priest perhaps might feel because he's you know, working for the bishop and he depends on the bishop, he might feel less willing to do that. So I think it's terrific.
Hmm. Do you sense a change in parishes? I mean, I know you're not a parish priest, but among Catholics that you know, do you sense a change in how they feel about their responsibilities toward the church?
I sense an enormous change. Actually, even though I'm not a parish priest, I am. I work at a local Jesuit parish up the street, and have a chance to speak with people, and certainly speak with, you know, many, many Catholics across the country. There is a change, and there's first of all, there's a great outrage. I mean, Catholics across the United States, it's not every single Catholic, but I would say the majority of Catholics are angry at primarily the bishops. I think they're disappointed in some of their priests. Although, you know, we're talking about a very, very small percentage of priests. I think the New York Times said something like 250 have been removed out of 46,000, which is, you know, less than 1%. So there is a sense of Catholics rallying around their local priests, but they're very disturbed by this crisis, and I think they're more disturbed by the cover-up than they are about the crimes, because I think it seems to me that most Catholics are able to say, all right, well, these guys were sick people that, you know, needed treatment, and it's a horrible thing, and it's tragic for the children and the families. But I think that what most Catholics find more frustrating is the shuffling around of some of these priests by some of the bishops. So there's anger. There's also a great feeling of impotence, because there's a sense that's growing that laypersons have no real voice in terms of the power structures in the church. So interestingly, what's happening in a lot of theological circles is a reaching back into the Second Vatican Council, which happened in the 1960s, the early 1960s, and a recovery of this notion of baptism as the entree for lay people to exercise their ministry in the church. Because really, you know, the church is, as the Second Vatican Council said, the people of God. It's not simply the hierarchy. So the short answer to your question is there's a tremendous amount of anger, and there's also a feeling of impotence that I think they're trying that lay people are trying to grapple with today.
Interesting. Back to this idea of the lay committee. You know, I'm kind of wondering though. You know, what if the bishop doesn't agree with the findings or recommendations of the committee? Has that question come up?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. One of the main questions that has come up is, this committee still reports to the bishop. You know, I think that disturbs people. But I think, in a sense, you know, the bishop is still running the diocese, so it's not surprising that this lay committee would report to the bishop. Now, I think there's two things that mitigate that. One, each diocese will now, according to this charter that was adopted in Dallas, have to publish, as it were, through the U.S. bishop's office, whether or not they are adhering to these policies. So there's going to be a very public, disclosure of what each diocese is doing. And also, in point of fact, if you have lay experts, if you're going to pick a blue ribbon panel of high-profile lay experts, and the bishop decides not to listen to them, well, you know, they'll be happy, I think, to go to the press and complain, you see, whereas a priest would probably be less likely to do that. So I think, in a sense, there's a built-in, a built-in system of checks and balances which would encourage the bishop to really take what these people have to say seriously. And then the third thing is I think that the bishops are so horrified themselves about this situation that they're really looking towards these boards and these lay people to help them. Now, ironically, a lot of bishops say, and I think this is understandable, that when they relied on lay experts in the past, who said that people who had problems with pedophilia and sexual abuse could be treated, and then who said that these people could be brought back into ministry, they got into trouble. So I think the bishops, you know, are facing a difficult situation too, because really you had people saying these kinds of things pretty recently, saying that these people could be treated, they could be put back into ministry. So it's a very difficult situation. But I think that the idea of having lay boards with lay experts is a good idea.
Mm. This afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, we're talking with Jesuit priest James Martin. Father Martin was working in corporate America when he experienced his call to the priesthood. He worked for General Electric in corporate finance and human resources for 6 years. Father Martin is associate editor of America, the National Catholic Weekly magazine. He's the author of two books, including In Good Company, The Fast Track from the Corporate World to Poverty, Chastity, and Obedience. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite your questions. Join us with a phone call in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting to talk with us in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for your insights. Some of the things I've been reading lately and historically have heard in some of the studies that I did earlier on, I'm a former Catholic, had to do with the separation of the legal power of the church from the legal system in the country under which the church operated. And I know back in the Middle Ages, from some of my history classes from way back when, I understood that the priests and the bishops could go to a church court rather than the lay court, and therefore this became indigenous or endemic to the whole system, where the legal situation or the legal issues were not addressed by through the legal operating. For example, I was a teacher. If I had done some of the things that the priests had been accused of doing, I would have been turned over to the local legal authorities. And the priests were not treated in the same way. And is that a historical line, or am I way off base there? I'd like you to address that issue. Thank you.
Yeah, I think there is such a thing as what your caller is talking about is canon law, which would be the law that governs the way the church operates. And I always tell people it's the same kind of, you know, any organization has to have rules and regulations. And mostly canon law talks about things like, you know, who can be baptized and, you know, how do marriages work and, you know, who elects the pope and stuff like that. But I think in this country, and I think in all countries these days, that's this sort of reliance on canon law really only has to do with internal church matters. And there are no priests these days who feel that, well, I shouldn't say no, but, you know, if you're a priest or if you're working within the church, you still understand that you're subject to civil law. I think that the problem with the sexual abuse stuff, it's a very good question, though, has less to do with this separation of canon and civil law and more to do with the bishop's inability to even grasp what they were dealing with in terms of the sexual abuse. So I don't think, although I can't speak for the bishops, but I don't think this is a situation where they were trying to sort of hide behind canon law. I think it was more a situation where they were totally, you know, incapable of really understanding the depth of this problem and also relying on people, you know, psychiatrists who had told them, you know, these people can be treated and these people can be rehabilitated. So while there is that canon law, civil law distinction, I don't think it played as much of a role in the crisis as the caller might be thinking it did.
Okay, I want to thank the caller for her call this afternoon and go on to another caller on line two in Urbana, a listener on a cell phone. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I had several questions. When I started doing some research on this, and I prevail against this evil because I was victimized by a priest as a seven-year-old child, I was really rather horrified to find since the 1990s the church has had treatment centers for priests, and yet they do such very little outreach for people who are victims. I no longer reside in the diocese where I was assaulted, and I am still waiting for any kind of response for pastoral care for either the diocese I reside in or the one that that this occurred in. And my experience is, one, the diocese that it happened in is so overrun with reports that they can't handle the flood, and the diocese where I live, where there isn't very many problems, doesn't have any systems in place for assisting victims unless you reside closer to where their offices are. I think that's a big problem. And the other thing that I discovered just by going on Angels and Saints online is that there's a Saint Rusticus in like the 600s who was put in a monastery to serve his victim, who was Saint Goar, to live a life of recollection. And it would seem to me that any bishop could have gone to their own history books to find the answer that would have been more appropriate than what was done, you know, in terms of the appropriate placement of someone who assaults another person sexually. And that's all I had to say.
Well, I would say, first of all, I would like to apologize for what it's worth to the caller, you know, for what she experienced, which I'm sure was devastating to her when she was very young. I couldn't hear the call very much, but it sounded like she said when she was seven.
Right.
That's the first thing. The second thing is, I think that the caller is correct. There was, in the past, and I think the Dallas meeting was trying to address this, a much greater emphasis on treating the priest. I think this comes out of the bishop's sort of close context with the priest and the sense of the bishop as sort of the father to the priests, at the expense of victims. There was, for whatever reason, there was a really, I think, tragic misunderstanding of the need to reach out to victims. Now, I think one of the good things, one of the very good things about the Dallas charter is that right up front it talks about reaching out to victims and helping them in terms of, you know, any sort of care that they need, you know, follow-up. So I think that's a step in the right direction. And, you know, responding to what the caller was rightly saying, it was, you know, was a real imbalance in the way that the church was dealing with victims. The second part of the call, I couldn't hear her very well. Did she say that there was a priest that went into a monastery in the 6th century? Was that the story?
That's the gist of it. Yeah, I think that's right. I don't know if the caller is still there or not.
Who had committed sexual abuse, was it?
Right. And then was turned around and was in service to the person that he victimized.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that would be a pretty good penance for, some of the priests. I think that, this notion of penance and prayer, and as the caller said, recollection and praying for people and actually doing active service is I think that's a fine idea. I think, priests who have victimized other people have the responsibility not only to get treatment, or the church has a responsibility not only to get them treatment, but the victimizer himself, I think, has to ask himself, now what is my response to this sinful behavior that I have engaged in? How do I reconcile myself to the community? And yeah, I think certainly, some sort of penance is in order for these people as well. One person suggested, having them, work sort of menial tasks, as a way of kind of paying back. So I think that would be perfectly appropriate. I think that, if the church asks people to do penance in the confessional, that it's appropriate for the church itself to do penance.
Mm. Let's talk with another caller, a listener in Thawville on the toll-free line. Hello. Is there a caller there on line 4? Okay, I think we've got you now.
Oh.
Thawville?
Yeah.
Hi, go ahead.
All right. I was wondering if you could comment on this. This has bothered me since September 11th. I've been wondering why our clergy, and I mean all the denominations, wasn't more aware of what some of the Islamic teachings were.
I think that, our clergy in the United States is also, part of American culture, and I think in general, American culture is not very curious about things international. I think that most Americans, this is a gross exaggeration, but, most Americans are interested more in the United States, and so there's a lot less reading that goes on about other cultures. And I think that I would assume the caller is talking about clergy members, Christian clergy and Jewish clergy, are more focused on their own traditions. And I think that, one of the lessons of September 11th is this gross sort of misunderstanding not only of Islam itself, but also of the importance of Islam in the world at large. But I think if September 11th did anything, is that it made us all world citizens. So I guess the answer to the caller's question is that, the American clergy are not immune to some of the problems of American culture.
Do you mostly just study in your own, whatever you are, if you're a Catholic or a Lutheran, do you just mostly study your own line of thinking?
I think, yes, you do. I think, for example, in my training, we certainly studied other religions, but, needless to say, we were much more concentrated on Catholicism, just because that's what we're doing, 95% of our day, though we're in dialogue with people from other religions. And I think this is a good starting point for a lot of interfaith and ecumenical dialogue. People always say, before you can dialogue with other people from other religions, you have to understand your own religion first, which I think makes sense. But, the challenge is not to simply stop there, but to continue and try to understand other religions.
I want to thank the listener in Thawville for her questions this afternoon. I've got 3 callers waiting, and we only have a couple of minutes left in the program this afternoon. So let's go on to another caller in Urbana on line 1. Good afternoon.
Hello. My question is kind of along the lines of American culture, and I know you've worked in the corporate world. I'm curious as to the church's position on what happens in American business, particularly in the light of Enron and so many other corporations. It's, at first that seemed like an anomaly. Now it seems more like standard operating procedures for corporate executives. And I was wondering, if the church has addressed some of these ethical and moral matters in American business, if it hasn't addressed it, why not? And I think also I'd like to say that I think business ethics are what is determined as business ethics really clashes with cultural ethics and I would say even church morals. So I know you've had experience in the corporate world and now you're a Jesuit, and I'd like you to, if you would, talk a little bit about the church's stand and viewpoint on ethics in American business. Thank you.
Well, I think the church has spoken out about that. One of the, as they say, the best kept secret in the Catholic Church is Catholic social teaching that has a long, long history of addressing economic and business problems. And, you know, this has been the case for the past, say, I think 150 years. So there's a long tradition of Catholic social teaching in terms of, you know, respecting human dignity and understanding of the rights of workers, supporting unions, things like that. You know, more broadly, the church, the church in general, has taught about personal responsibility and morality. But, you know, I think more to the point, I think there's been a lot of writing these days about the value of business ethics in, you know, in the current world. And I think one of the things I always like to point out to people is that what religious thinkers and the church can contribute is the notion that while the business owes its, you know, owes its operations to the shareholders and owes shareholders a return on their investment, that's not the only thing that businesses are responsible for. That's not their only responsibility. There's a responsibility to the individuals who work there. There's a responsibility to the community. There's a responsibility to the world. So I think, in general, what the church has tried to say to business people and to businesses at large is that your sole responsibility, you don't have a responsibility, let me put it this way, you have more than just a responsibility to your shareholders. You have a responsibility to a much larger population. So I think that, combined with kind of Christian moral thinking, is really how the church tries to address some of these problems today.
I want to thank the caller for his call. Let's get in one more caller, even though we're tight on time here. Line two, another caller in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hi, I'll make it quick, and I think this is a very naive question, but I don't understand. Isn't it illegal to sexually abuse children, and so why is there all this talk about one strike, you're out, two, don't you go to jail?
The short answer to the question is yes. I mean, if it is proven that you've sexually abused children, you do go to jail. Then that's, yeah, you're right. It's a pretty simple question.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, let's squeeze in one more caller, our last caller this afternoon. Line three, Champagne. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. This is a very short question.
Good.
are you familiar with the works of Malachi Martin?
Yes.
Have you read his last novel?
I've only read the book he did on the Jesuits. I didn't read the last novel, though.
Okay, his last novel touches on all the child abuse problem, so I'll leave it at that.
Oh, okay. No, I haven't read that. Although, yeah, Malachi Martin, who's a former Jesuit, sometimes, shall we say, plays pretty fast and loose with the facts. So I think he's a better novelist than he is a nonfiction writer.
Okay, I want to thank the caller for his call this afternoon. And we're here at the end of the time we can spend together today. Father Martin, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
James Martin has been our guest. If you're interested in his book, In Good Company, here's the title, In Good Company, The Fast Track from the Corporate World to Poverty, Chastity, and Obedience. The book is published by Sheed and Ward.